Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that spent 50 years buried under a glacier, and the stubborn, half-crazy crew of folks who decided that was no place for a Lightning to spend eternity. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar, where we sit a spell and talk about the machines and the men and women who got us all up into the blue. And today's story has everything I love: a warbird, a wartime mystery, a rescue that took longer than the war itself. So settle in. Now, before we get rolling, let me tip my hat to today's sponsor, because they get what we're about here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, the airplane I'm about to tell you about, she's nothing but story, top to bottom. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back to the summer of 1942. Picture the North Atlantic. The war is on, and America needs to get fighters and bombers across the ocean to England. Now you can't just point a single engine fighter at the Atlantic and tell the pilot good luck. The airplanes didn't have the legs for it, not safely. So somebody cooked up what they called Operation Bolero. The idea was to hop the airplanes across the top of the world, up through Maine, over to Greenland, onto Iceland, then down into Scotland. Short legs. Stepping stones across the roof of the Atlantic on the 15th of July, 1942, a flight of airplanes lifted off bound for that crossing. Two B-17 Flying Fortresses to navigate, and a half dozen P-38 Lightnings tucked in around them like ducklings. Now, if you've never stood next to a P-38, let me paint you the picture. Twin booms, twin Allison engines, counter-rotating so they didn't try to twist the airplane off the runway. A pod in the middle for the pilot, bristling with guns and a cannon right in the nose. The Germans called it the fork-tailed devil. It was fast, it was beautiful. And on that July day, it was about to meet weather that didn't care how pretty it was. They flew straight into it, a wall of snow and cloud over the Greenland ice cap. No radar like we've got. No GPS. Just a wet compass, a watch, and a prayer. They tried to climb over it, couldn't. Tried to go under. The ice cap rose up to meet them. Fuel was burning down, and now they were trapped between a frozen ceiling and a frozen floor, and the only thing left to do was the thing no pilot ever wants to do. Put her down, on the ice. Here's where it gets interesting. Every single one of those airplanes, all eight, made it onto that glacier. The B-17 crews kept the wheels up and bellied them in. The Lightning pilots, well, the first one put his gear down out of habit, and the moment those wheels touched the soft snow, the airplane flipped right over onto its back. After that, the others got the message and bellied them in too. Skidded across the ice on their aluminum. And not one man died. 25 souls walked away from 8 airplanes on top of a Greenland glacier. They huddled in the fuselages, melted snow for water, and they waited. For 9 days they waited in that white nothing, until the rescue crews on dog sleds and ski planes finally got every last one of them out. They walked home. The airplanes did not. Now think about that. 8 warbirds, brand new, sitting up there on the ice cap, perfectly intact. The war moved on. Everybody figured, eh? The snow will cover them, and someday somebody will come dig them out and fly them home. They called the whole bunch the Lost Squadron. Somebody always wants to go back. The trouble is, when they finally did go back, the airplanes weren't where they left them, and they weren't sitting in a few feet of snow either. Let me explain what a glacier does, because this is the part that just floors me every time. A glacier is a river of ice, moving so slow you can't see it, but moving all the same, and every year up there, more snow falls than melts. So that snow piles on, and it packs down, year after year, decade after decade, into solid ice. Those airplanes weren't just getting covered, they were sinking. The whole ice cap was swallowing them and carrying them sideways at the same time. So here come the dreamers. Through the 70s and 80s, expedition after expedition went up to Greenland trying to find the Lost Squadron. They had old maps. They had the pilots' recollections, and they found nothing but a flat white desert, because the airplanes had drifted miles from where anybody thought they'd be, and they were buried so deep that even radar had a hard time picking them out. Finally, a couple of fellows named Pat Epps and Richard Taylor, an aviator and an architect out of Atlanta, who'd caught the fever bad, partnered up with the right people, and brought along ground-penetrating radar, the kind of gear that can see down through solid ice. And in 1988, they got a hit. Something big and metal, way down deep, when they finally drilled down and put a probe on it, the numbers came back and just about knocked everybody flat. 268 feet. Let that sit a second. The airplanes were under 268 feet of solid ice. That's deeper than a football field is long, straight down. And they'd traveled something like 2 miles from where they were abandoned. Half a century of snowfall had built a frozen tomb the height of a 20-story building right on top of those lightnings. Now most sensible people would have stood there, looked at that number and gone home. 268 feet. You can't dig that, you can't blast it, you'd shred the airplane. What in the world do you do? Here's what they did, and this is the part where I just shake my head in admiration. They built a machine. A thing they called the Gopher. It was essentially a great big coil of copper tubing they pumped full of near-boiling water, and they lowered it down onto the ice and let it melt its way straight down. Melted a shaft about 4 feet across, like a wet straw poking down through 50 years of winter. Down and down and down, day after day, in some of the most miserable weather God ever invented, until at the bottom of that shaft, 268 feet beneath their boots, a glove came back up touching airplane. They'd found her. A P-38 Lightning sitting on her belly right where she'd skidded to a stop in 1942. And then they had the real fun. Because finding her and getting her out are two different animals entirely. They had to melt out a whole cavern down there at the bottom, a room carved in the ice with steam, working in the cold and the wet and the dark with the weight of the whole glacier pressing in around them. The airplane had been squeezed by all that ice, the booms were crushed in places, the wings had folded, she was not going to come up in one piece, so they took her apart down there. In that ice cave at the bottom of the world, by hand, piece by piece, and they hauled every component up that narrow melted shaft to the surface. Engines, wings, the cockpit pod, bit by bit, a fighter that had been entombed since before most of us were born, came back up into the daylight. That was 1992, took them years and a fortune in money and more frostbite than anybody likes to talk about, but they got her out. Now here's where the story turns, from a recovery into a resurrection. And this is the part for everybody out there who's ever knelt on a hangar floor with a parts manual and a skinned knuckle wondering what in the world you got yourself into. They trucked her home and they rebuilt her? Down in Middlesboro, Kentucky, a crew of craftsmen spent the better part of 10 years putting that Lightning back together. And I don't mean they bolted the old crushed parts back on and called it a museum piece. I mean they brought her back to flying condition, where a part was too far gone. They fabricated a new one to the original drawings. They rebuilt those Allison engines. They worked sheet metal the way it was worked in the 40s. They gave her back her dignity. They named her Glacier Girl. And on the 26th of October, 2002, 60 years after she skidded to a stop on that ice cap, a pilot fired up those two Allisons, taxied out, pushed the throttles up, and Glacier Girl lifted off the runway and flew 60 years, from the bottom of a glacier back into the sky where she belonged. I've heard from folks who were standing on that ramp the day she flew, and they all say the same thing, grown men crying, because it isn't just an airplane, it's a promise kept to 25 young men who put their fighters down on the ice and walked away, figuring somebody someday would bring one of them home. Took 50 years to find her, and 10 more to heal her, but somebody did. Now you might ask, what about the other seven? The other Lightnings and the two fortresses? They're still up there, still under the ice, still drifting along with that glacier an inch at a time. Maybe somebody will go back for another one someday. I hope they do, but for now, Glacier Girl flies for all of them. Back when Abagus was cheap and airspace was free, an old-timer told me that an airplane never really wants to quit. You can crash it, you can sink it, you can bury it under 268 feet of Greenland ice for half a century. And if there's anybody left who remembers what she was, somebody will come dig her out and make her whole. I didn't believe him at the time. Glacier Girl made a believer out of me. For the bones of this story, I'm indebted to the folks behind the Greenland Expedition Society who actually did the digging, to the warbird historians who've kept the Lost Squadron's tale alive all these years, and to the United States Army Air Force's records of Operation Bolero that tell us how those airplanes came to be up there in the first place. You can find more of what we do over at radiohangar.com. And the next time you're feeling like some project of yours is too far gone to bother with, you remember a fork-tailed devil that flew again after 60 years in the deep freeze. Nothing's too far gone. This is Tail Dragger. Keep the dirty side down, and I'll see you next time.